Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make classic art house and indie cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Sweatman, and today we have another discussion of a great classic film called The Best Years of Our Lives. We are in the middle of a series on classic film essentials, where we are watching and discussing our way through six of the biggest and best titles from the classic era. If you are new to classic movies or wanting to broaden your classic Hollywood knowledge, this series is for you. My guest, Rance Collins, is a film writer and classic cinema expert, and he's back again today to bring in all the juicy historical details surrounding the movie, so stay tuned for that. But first, I usually open the show with a little rundown for the Arkansas listeners of some of the film events happening around the state. We are still in the middle of coronavirus self-isolation, so there isn't really anything to report. All events have been canceled or postponed. But there is a really exciting virtual event you can attend from your sofa, and that is the special home edition of the TCM Classic Film Festival. Here's Rance Collins with a little bit more information about that.
Next weekend, starting April 16th through the 19th, Turner Classic Movies, if you get the channel or if you have, or if you can just log on to any of their online resources through their website and YouTube and whatnot, they are doing a virtual film festival where they are going to have basically 4 days of programming and special features online that are exclusively about previous festivals. They're going to show some of the Q&As from their 10 years of film festivals where they interviewed so many huge Hollywood heavyweights. And they'll show movies that have played at the festival before with that extra added context of getting these interviews that I think it's actually really cool that they're airing them, because most of these Q&As that were either before or after these films, they were only seen in the context of an audience where, you know, maybe a few hundred people could fit into a theater to listen to Eva Marie Saint or whoever talk about this movie. But now everybody gets to see some of the cool stuff that I have seen firsthand. And, you know, you saw last year, I mean, you saw a couple of Q&As.
Yeah, I went to see From Here to Eternity, and they had a Q&A. Mm-hmm. Then I also saw, I almost said Portrait of a Lady on Fire. No, A Woman Under the Influence. And yes, that was introed by Ben Mankiewicz, so that was a really amazing thing, too. It's a great festival. It's a very sad thing that it can't happen this year, but it's exciting that some of this is going to be online, and a lot more people will be able to experience it from the comfort of your own home, which is nice.
Yeah, I know. And, I mean, like, I had a suit all ready for the red carpet this time around, man. And I'm sadly not going to get to wear that. But
I don't know. Listeners may not know this, but Rance can friggin' rock a suit too. So it's a loss for us all, and I'm not joking.
I don't know why. You know, when you promote this episode, just show my red carpet look from last year. It's the time. I work the festival, but I take a picture on the red carpet like I'm a guest.
Yeah.
Like I am
a famous person.
An honoree. Yeah. But no, it's an incredible experience. And kind of just speaking to what this whole series has been about, you know, the celebration of film and the impact it's had in our lives and the way that that movies can continue to resonate to new generations. I mean, that's kind of what the entire mission statement of Turner Classic Movies would be.
Yeah.
And they do a better job of making movies that are 50, 60, 70, 80 years old feel fresh than just about anybody.
Yeah.
And I highly, highly recommend supporting them in any way that you can, but also just, you know, checking out maybe some of the stuff that will be available this coming week.
All right, back to today's movie. The Best Years of Our Lives is a Best Picture winner that came out in 1946. It tells the story of three veterans coming home from war and the challenges they face reintegrating into society and into their families. I'll admit that on paper, a drama about World War II veterans didn't sound that appealing to me. But oh my gosh, this movie is fantastic. It stars Myrna Loy, Dana Andrews, and Frederick March, along with some others, and it was directed by William Wyler. If you aren't familiar with those people, stay tuned because we're going to break it all down. Here is my discussion with Rance Collins about the best years of our lives. Hello, welcome back, Rance Collins. How are you doing today?
I am isolated.
Isolated, yes. This is
but good.
In the middle of coronavirus season. If you're listening, you know, months from now, that's when we're recording this. So we're stuck at home watching movies and...
Assuming that months from now the situation has changed.
Yeah, fingers crossed. you know, if things are still in existence at all and you're able to listen to a podcast... We were recording this during coronavirus,
but yep.
Yeah, so this is, you know, the first social interaction I've had outside of my immediate family in a few days. So that's nice. Good to talk to you, Rance.
I'm so honored.
yeah, that's the real reason to do a podcast right now. But anyway, we actually do have a great movie to talk about, and that is The Best Years of Our Lives. This movie won Best Picture. Came out in 1946. This is one that I had not even heard of when you we were kind of nailing down some titles to watch through. And honestly, it's one that I think just on the surface of reading the description, I wasn't that excited about it. But I think it's a case of if a screenwriter can get to like the authentic truth of a situation, it's super compelling, no matter what that situation is. And so what this is about is basically veterans, three men that come home from World War II, and it's really difficult to reintegrate into their families, into society, and it kind of follows those challenges. And it's really well told story, and the drama of that story is really compelling. And it's really great. I was really I'm gonna count this in my top of, you know, that era going forward, because I really, really fell in love with this movie. What's your relationship with this film?
I think the first time I watched it was, I don't know how old I was, probably 16, 17, because I was that kid. But
yes, you were.
Yeah. I remember it was one of the DVDs that I got in this birthday quest that I had. My dad, for my birthday, my mom and dad took me to Fry's Electronics in Dallas, and or Dallas area. I don't know what actual part of Dallas Fry's is in.
I've heard of that.
Or if it still exists. I don't know. you know, this was like 2004. Who knows?
Yeah.
Like but
DVDs and stuff for sale there. Yeah.
And we went in, and he said, "Okay, for your birthday, you can have 20 DVDs."
Wow.
And I know.
That's an amazing birthday present.
I mean, like, for a cinephile in 2004, the idea that you could see 20 more movies.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And this was one of the DVDs that I got. And I was familiar with a couple of the people who are in it. Mm-hmm. I really love Myrna Loy.
Yeah.
Who is best known to a lot of people for being Nora Charles in the Thin Man series. Very bubbly, light in all of those movies, very comedic, and known for being kind of the straight man in comedic situations, actually.
Interesting.
In the 30s, she was at one point crowned the Queen of Hollywood with Clark Gable as the king. And she was known kind of for being the perfect wife. That's what they called her. And this movie does certainly stack up to that title too. And she got top billing because at the time she was the biggest star.
Yeah, she's the biggest face on the poster and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, even though she has more of a supporting part in the movie. Teresa Wright, I knew from the Hitchcock film Shadow of a Doubt.
She's great in this.
Yeah, she's great in this. She's great in everything I've seen her in. She plays this, she's a very, both she and Myrna Loy have this very all-American girl next door quality about them that is so likable and so relatable. And they are very, very pretty, but they're also very down to earth and approachable.
You grounded, know, grounded and like and kind of idyllic, but not perfect people either. I think, and in this at least, they feel like people you could really know, and there's something grounded in reality about them.
And in this type of story, that's just like perfect.
Yeah.
And then I don't. I think this may have been the first big thing I saw with Frederick March, but Frederick March is a huge actor in the 30s and 40s. He won Best Actor for this movie. He over Jimmy Stewart in It's Wonderful Life, interestingly. Oh, wow. And he won another Oscar in the 30s for playing Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And yeah, and he was in the original version of A Star Is Born.
Oh, really?
Playing the alcoholic Norman Maine, who became Jackson Maine when he was played by Bradley Cooper.
Well, and that's fitting for this movie too, because he's a bit of an alcoholic here as well.
Yes, he is. Anyway, so you know, I knew some of these cast members. The director William Wyler is my favorite director of all time. He also did the most famous films he did were probably Roman Holiday, Ben-Hur, the 1959 Ben-Hur, Funny Girl with Barbara Streisand. He did a trio of great Bette Davis movies, The Letter, Jezebel, and The Little Foxes. He did a great film called Dodsworth from the late 30s. He just did all these different movies, quite a few of which were well-known. He won multiple Best Director Oscars. He won also for this movie, Mrs. Miniver and Ben-Hur, all of which won Best Picture. And none of the movies, if you were to like put them all up against each other, the only quality that you would say they have in common is that they're all competently made great films. And yet they have nothing.
I'd say I think he came up in our one of our previous episodes, and we just noted the diversity, or you noted the diversity there of vastly different, like Ben-Hur, and then a movie like this, and a movie like Roman Holiday, all the same guy. It's surprising, and you don't and quite see that like, kind of thing today.
No, it's kind of something that you had to, and that's not uncommon amongst directors during the studio era, where directors were just kind of assigned to a project, and you know, I mean, like, there's the director who did Casablanca, Michael Curtiz. We talked about him and the fact that he did, you know, like, this great adventure movie, The Adventure of Robin Hood, and then he did Casablanca, and then he did White Christmas, you know, and those movies have nothing in common with each other. But, I mean, the people in the studio era were like, okay, you're going to go do this, and you're going to do a good job doing it.
Yeah.
And
get used to the idea. Yeah.
You know, it was like, it was more like Hitchcock who really, I think, put forth the idea of a director having a certain style, you know,
a niche.
But anyway, this movie I knew because the cast, I knew it won Best Picture. I knew it was something I needed to watch. It had that title that feels important, you know, like I have to watch this movie. It's in the AFI Top 100. It's one of only three movies in the Top 100 that didn't move places between the 1998 and 2007 list. I think it's like 35 on both. That number could be wrong. I don't.
But somewhere in the middle-ish.
It's 30-something. I feel like that's accurate. But Citizen Kane and The Godfather Part 2 are the other two movies that didn't move, by the way.
Interesting. Which what number is... So Citizen Kane is one, right?
Citizen Kane's one. And The Godfather Part 2 is... It's in the top half of the list. I forget where. But, you know, The Godfather's in, is like number three on one list and number two on the other. But it trades places with Casablanca. But yeah, but Part 2 is farther... Yeah, it has a higher I guess a lower placing
right.
on the list. But I mean, like, that's, I mean, like, we yeah, have a whole other podcast hairs. Series yeah. debating whether or yeah. not Godfather 2 or 1 is better, because mm-hmm. I feel like I change my mind on that all the time. But Best Years, that's how I came to it. Very long story of how I came to Best Years of Our Lives. Then I watched it, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I've revisited it several times over the years. Mm. And I've seen it in a movie theater as well, as I have quite a few of these movies we've discovered. the thing that I love about this movie, the reason I wanted to include it on this series, is that World War II mobilized the entirety of Hollywood and the nation as well. And, you know, you get, we talked about World War II when we were dealing with Casablanca and the impact it had on the studio system. But after, you know, 3-4 years of fighting this war, almost 4 years, the America was in the war. You had this, this country that, I mean, like, imagine like a situation like the coronavirus and the way that has brought all of us together, and it persists for 4 years. And yeah, you know, businesses were able to remain operational, but like a sizable percentage of the workforce was gone, and women were placed into executive roles for the first time in their lives, because the men were off at war. And you come back, you know, like, then that ends, and it's been going on for so long that it became very much the norm. And then that ends, and it's just kind of a lot of like, okay, what now? And the Hollywood response is interesting. I mean, you have movies like Double Indemnity was made during the war, but you have a lot of movies that are kind of the tone of Double Indemnity that that happened right after film noir like really explodes right after World War II in the late 40s. And you have that, you know, everyone thinks about the baby boom, but there's also this like incredible darkness that sets in, because suddenly the world does not look as sunny, because we've been exposed to some really harsh realities that, I mean, make the poverty of the Great Depression look like child's play compared to the murder and cold-blooded hate that, I mean, I think that America in a way was immune to until they had to see those. And so you see themes about not necessarily Best Years of Our Lives, but you see in a lot of these movies themes of anti-Semitism creep into film, and you see you have a movie like It's a Wonderful Life, which is shown every single Christmas, that everybody remembers for being this happy-go-lucky thing, but the movie is about a person who's about to commit suicide. And he has to be reminded that people love him, and that people are dealing with PTSD really on a higher scale for the first time. It's like, I mean, like, that stuff always existed, but all this stuff is like coming into consciousness. And Best Years of Our Lives, I think, helps to show America in a moment and gives you a real opportunity to see where people were, in a way that is surprisingly stark and honest for 1946. And that is still told within a frame that is compelling and entertaining and has likable actors and stars holding the fort. But you get kind of this slice of American pie that is a little bitter, but very real.
I was gonna say, echo some of that. You get a real sense of what society was like, you know, at least for this people in this kind of city, a real kind of boots on the ground, like, what was it like to live in this time period? And this is a perfect pairing with Casablanca, you know, which came out during the war, and it was still, you know, it's incredibly patriotic, and, you know, we're going to beat the Nazis and the bad guys, and yet they don't know if they're going to win. And then fast forward, here we are, we've won the war, people are coming home.
Now what?
What do we do now? Yeah, and it really was, like, watching this in the middle of coronavirus was really interesting, because it's different, obviously very different, but something about... there's this unusual way that society has been for a while, and looking forward to when that ends and realizing, you know, it's not going to be easy in some ways, but there's also joy that comes with that too. And like the scene where Fred comes home to his wife for the first time, to Myrna Loy.
What a great scene.
Like, they haven't seen each other in like 3 years or something. And they're just surprised, and he has come earlier than expected, and so they're caught off guard. And I just imagine, like, what was that like? That's such a crazy experience that so many of our grandparents had, you know? Think this series of films that we've watched has really given me a new appreciation for, like, American history around this time. And I think that's
remarkable. Yeah. I think I mentioned that, like, right off the bat. The remarkable thing about film is that this history is recorded. Mm-hmm. Like, we have the opportunity, I'm not just talking about documentary footage or whatever.
Yeah,
sure, we can actually go back and look at footage from D-Day, but we can go back and watch these movies, which ultimately represent the way people were thinking and feeling and interacting with each other. And I mean, like, think about how coronavirus might change us.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that we may become people who do not shake hands
and
who do not hug as often and things like that. And now, and even the way that, like, a couple of years ago, Me Too positively changed the culture, and how there's movies from 5 years ago that feel offensive and dated because of the way that women are treated in the film. And there are movies that 5 years from now that are current that will feel, I mean, like, there's things I'm watching on TV that were filmed a few months ago right now, and I'm thinking, like, ooh, they're way too close to each other. So that's the amazing thing about having history marked, is that we can see these changes, we can get in the heads of these people, and that's what's just love about this movie.
I've already been thinking, what kind of movies are we going to get out of coronavirus, and, like, stories that are told about this time, because it's such a weird thing that we're in the middle of. But yeah, I was gonna say, I think learning
about 15 years we get a Quentin Tarantino film where
where
there's an alternate history, I mean, like, a different president or something that heads off the past.
I like it. They blowtorch the coronavirus somehow with it.
They blowtorch. Yes, there's
Leo shows up and just burns it all up.
Leo shows up.
I can't wait for that movie. But yeah, I'm just thinking about, like, just if you're someone who, you know, like me growing up, I thought history was really boring. It was like my least favorite subject. But I think there's no better way than watching movies to really feel the stories and like understand what it might have actually been like. So anyway, all that to say, this movie does that in a great way. And
And I mean, if we've gotten this far, I feel like a very light description might be helpful.
Yeah, I was about to say, let's dig into there's kind of three main storylines here, and they kind of kick off and are kind of intertwined a little bit too.
Yes. So, this movie, first of all, everyone should know this is like a 3-hour film.
Yes.
You have nothing to do. We are stuck inside.
Yes. I will say it moves fast. It really does. Even though it's, you know, kind of a pacey drama, it didn't feel like a slog, I guess, to get through.
Yeah. And it's not melodramatic either. It's a very, it's a very, there's a very natural pace to it that that feels very, genuine. But the movie has three different soldiers who are returning home to a city that I forget what the name they give it.
Yeah,
it's Boone City.
Yeah, I think that's right. Boone City. I'll look and see. But is that a real city?
No, it's not. And they don't mention the state. They don't mention any of that stuff. And I think the idea is this is just a typical Midwestern mid-level American city, you know, probably like a Cleveland or a, you know, just some type of a couple hundred thousand people, You know, it Cleveland is, probably has more than that, but you know.
Boone City is right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Double check that.
It's funny how you watch a movie enough times, the facts just retain themselves. Yeah. They all ranked differently in the military. Mm. They all had different experiences, but they all happen to be going home to the same city, and they spend like their plane ride, which they have to take like a aircraft carrier or something. Mm. Or a mail, I don't forget what it is, but they
take, it's like not a commercial plane at all.
Not a commercial plane, to get back, because I mean, this is like a note that I didn't even really think about till just now, but like there's so many people trying to get home at the beginning of the movie that it's hard to get a plane flight back.
Yeah, that's wild.
And so they all come home, and they all three have unique and different experiences, trying to acclimate back into society. And one of them is a patriarch of a family. He has two kids that have basically grown up without him being there.
This is Al, and played by Frederick March.
Al, played by Frederick March, who won an Oscar for the movie. And he comes home, and there's a whole new routine in the household. His son is like a teenager all of a sudden, and he has absolutely no interest in anything his dad wants to tell about.
Yeah.
And the movie doesn't have much interest in him either.
And he's a little bit anti-war too, which is really interesting to think about. Like, that was already happening. There's a little bit of conflict around that.
Yeah. And then you have the daughter who, I mean, presumably was probably still in high school when he left and now is an adult and has been working. And the mom, you know, like has been doing her thing, and all of them have been living this life without him. And then you have a second soldier who actually delays going to meet his wife by a night because he's so nervous about seeing her again.
This is Fred, played by Dana Andrews,
not to be confused with Frederick March,
right.
Fred, the character, played by Dana Andrews, who is like, you know, probably 30-ish and, you know,
Cary Grant, kind of vibe,
good looking.
Yeah.
And he has this wife that he married right before he got shipped off to war, and they didn't really know each other. And it was one of those, as there were many of them in the early 40s, right before we got into the war, a lot of people got married really quick. Because there was no telling if they get back. We got to get married. And so this is one of those wartime romances. And he gets back and he realizes he has nothing in common with his wife. And then you have the third guy who was a typical American boy who got shipped off to war and ended up coming back a paraplegic. And he is a real life war veteran who lost his lower arms and hands in the war, and William Wyler had seen him in a training film and decided to try and use him for the movie. He ended up giving a very good performance and won an Oscar, as well as an honorary Oscar.
I didn't realize he won.
He won supporting. He is Harold Russell.
Yes. Homer plays Homer.
Homer. And he gets back, and you know, his family is like obviously uncertain, uncomfortable. The fact that he has hooks for hands now, and the girl next door that was his sweetheart is like willing to look past that and pick up where they left off, but he is so conflicted and feels so emasculated in the real world, whereas, you know, when you're off at war and everybody's bothered, it doesn't matter. You know, when he's back in society, he doesn't know how to live with himself in a world where everyone's normal but him. And even though his girlfriend doesn't care, he can't open up to her.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. His arc, I think, is really fascinating since, and took real vulnerability on the actor's part, because he's actually disabled and he's talking about the way it feels. Like, he has a scene early on. So all three of them get home and are just uncomfortable and end up leaving that same night. And they go back to the same bar that they had mentioned before that his cousin Harold, Homer's cousin, owns. But he has a great conversation with his cousin about, you know, it's little things like they're staring at my hands, or they're trying not to stare at my hands. And I can tell my father feels guilty that he has hands still. And just kind of digs into some of those emotions that, as a non-disabled person, you might not think about. But it's really real. And then it ends up being that his girlfriend, is ready to accept him, and he can't believe that she is, and is not ready to. I guess we can kind of fast forward through what his story goes to, but there's a really emotional scene, probably the most emotional scene in the movie for me, when he finally, like, he'd just been distant and cold to her, and you're just like, why won't you just open up to her? And then kind of breaks down and shows her, here's what it's going to be like to be with me. Here's the things I cannot do for myself. And she loves him through it. And it's really touching. And his character arc is really fascinating.
Oh, I'm getting emotional just thinking about that scene. You know, because he goes step by step. And I mean, knowing that it's real really does add a level to it. But he goes through how to disassemble his makeshift body, you know, and how he has to do this every night, and how he can't do things for himself. And it's heavy, but it adds this level of authenticity to the entire movie that really drives home the reality.
Yeah. And I was just gonna say, when she accepts him and then he understands that she still wants to be with him through that, like, that is so beautiful. And so, oh my gosh, that was, very emotional. Really.
And think about, like, another thing about when this was made, this is a time when, he obviously can walk, but I mean, there weren't, places were not wheelchair accessible.
Right.
And there were not really laws in place to help anyone who was disabled.
As far as we still have to go today, like, they had so much further to go than we do now with that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And we obviously are still not as far as we should be, but, but it is interesting to look back and see this level of empathy and progression in a movie from this time period.
Yeah. You can imagine what this did for representation back then.
And during the course of the movie, there's also a love story that ends up developing between the adult daughter of Al. Thank you. Alan Milley.
Yes.
I think.
Like Myrna Loy.
Yes. Myrna Loy. The middle soldier, what's his name?
Fred.
Fred. Yes.
Yeah.
Fred.
So Fred, who has this wife, he doesn't really know. And so that first night doesn't go. She works at a nightclub as a singer, and he says he can't find her.
Peggy.
It kind of seems like he didn't try that hard either. Yeah. Peggy.
Yeah.
And so he still hasn't seen her, and they're with, his wife is, Peggy is the daughter of Al. His wife is Marie. Yeah, so he has not seen Marie, go ahead.
And Marie, I like that, even though Marie, if you were like the person and say like, oh, they're the villain in this movie because she doesn't support him, you know, I still think she's portrayed in a way that's pretty, that's somewhat empathetic too, because you understand where she's coming from too. Mm-hmm. Like, he doesn't want her to work anymore, even though that's what she's been doing all this time. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's just like they married somebody they thought was somebody else. Mm-hmm. And that, I'm sure, was the reality for a lot of people who had these last minute marriages. Mm-hmm. And,
It does a good job of showing. It does a good job of showing both sides of that. But at the same time, I wasn't expecting this movie to push that narrative as far as it does with their conflict and where that ends up going. Which I don't know if we want to spoil that or not. But
heavy spoiler alert right here.
Let's do that.
If you don't want to know, but he ends up. Spoiler now. he ends up. Uh, developing a relationship with Peggy. I think they end up kissing at one point.
They kiss,
And she does not, she accepts him, and she doesn't mind that, because I love this. I love this little fact, the fact that he was this, this high ranking official in the army, and he comes back and they're like, but like, what can you do? What skills do you have? And he has to be, the soda jerk at a drugstore.
Yeah. It's like his high school job he has to go back to. And now he's like a big important soldier, but that means nothing back in society.
Yeah. They don't care. And which is getting into a whole nother level of veterans' rights. I mean, like, there's just like so much stuff that's being talked about in this movie that's like right below the surface, and they don't really beat you over the head with it.
Yeah, that's true.
And the great, so that romance develops, and that ends up being really pivotal with him, and of course is a turning point, and gives us a happy ending for the movie. But the thing that I find fascinating about his story is that with him, they work in PTSD before it was called PTSD. And he wakes up in the middle of the night and he's having these horrific dreams, and he goes to an airplane graveyard and he relives his experiences. And, you know, and we were talking about how he had this job and he can't get a better job. You know, there's also the fact that his parents are very clearly on the wrong side of the tracks, and he is not as high in society back at home as he was overseas. And he is mentally scarred and he's emotionally scarred. And his character has a whole other fascinating arc, because he comes back to a world that is not only very different from him, but he's still carrying the world he left behind in a really scary and horrific way. Which, I mean, again, I'm sure so many soldiers came back and could not get it out of their mind that they killed people.
Yeah, I can imagine seeing that story on screen, and that's something you've been experiencing, and no one is talking about it. That must have been so cathartic and so helpful for people that were having that experience then.
And in truth, that's another thing, like, just like talking about disabled people's rights, this is something that as a society we don't really talk about for another few decades. You know, PTSD doesn't really become something better, a larger conversational topic, until after Vietnam. You know, and so the fact that this movie is putting that forth is so incredible. And then you have the dad, Al, who comes back, and, you know, he has a couple things going on too. He has to kind of reconnect with his wife, and they have a very strong marriage. That is obvious. There's a really great speech that she gives to the daughter at one point.
Oh, that's so great. That's a great scene.
Cause the daughter is, you know, frustrated because she's falling in love with Fred,
who's married,
and who's married, and she wants to break up the marriage. And then the parents are like, you know, like, maybe they don't love each other now, but maybe they will, you know, because how many times have I said I hated you and meant it in my heart? And there's this just beautiful speech. And Myrna Loy is such a subtle, wonderful actress that she delivers it with such grace. Just like the scene where we mentioned earlier, where they come home, where he comes home for the first time, and he tells the kids to be quiet, and she's down the hall, and she's like, kids, who's at the door, you know?
Yeah.
And they don't say anything, and then she realizes it's him, and and it's just amazing. Her, it's such a such a great moment. Anyway, but then he goes back to his job at the bank that he's had for presumably like 20 years, and the bank, you know, it's trying to be stingy with loans
to veterans in particular.
And he's wanting to help them get on their feet. And so he's come back this more empathetic person who's not doing his job the same way he did it before. And the biggest thing with him, and I love the way the movie handles this, because it is not a heavy point in the film, and it's not resolved.
Yeah.
But he develops a problem with alcohol throughout the course of the movie. And the movie does not put a button on that. And it doesn't, it makes it clear that it's a problem. There's one point where he's at this big dinner and he keeps having drinks, and his wife, Myrna Loy, is just marking off on a tablecloth with a little fork how many drinks he's had.
Tally marks.
And at the end of the film, there's a wedding that ends the movie between Homer and what was her name?
I just watched it a week ago. I should know this. I'll find out in a minute.
It's another one of those great Wilma, right?
Yes, Wilma. That's right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Homer and Wilma.
Homer.
Adorable.
Adorable. Almost sound like you're out of the Stone Age, but not quite. We do have a Fred and we have a Wilma in this movie.
Oh, yeah. There
Homer and Wilma are getting married. And right before that, we see the three soldiers together again, like they are at the beginning of the movie. And he's already tipsy. And you realize, like, this is, even though there's some jokes and laughs that are put into it, this is a problem that is not going away. And has become his coping mechanism. And I love the fact that the movie shows that, but doesn't even, I mean, like, it doesn't resolve it. Like, you can't, this is a problem that's going to persist.
It doesn't show it in a positive light at all, of course. Like, it it does see it as a problem. It's not resolved. And she's like, this is something he has to live with now.
Which is a great message leaving the movie. You know, you get, you know, two characters get kind of, the two of the soldiers get kind of their happy ending. And you have, you still have this idea that, okay, but this is life and there's still problems that are going to persist, you know?
One more note, go ahead.
Yes. And the, as far as the happy ending goes, I will, this is something we can maybe talk more about in a second. William Wyler, if he has any identifiable trait as a director, he worked a lot with a cinematographer we'll be talking more about next week, or in a couple, in next episode, I should say, Greg Toland, who was a pioneer in many, many ways, but he was the one credited with deep focus photography. And deep focus photography is where you're basically keeping a bunch of things in focus at once that are in the foreground and the background. And there are several instances in this movie, including the ending.
Yeah, like I know you're going with this, and it's the best shot in the movie. Incredible.
And there's a shot where you got Homer and Wilma getting married in the foreground. And on one side of the frame, you have Fred, who is a groomsman. And then on the far end, you know, they're just getting married in there. It's a very simple wedding in the living room.
Yeah.
On the far end in the background, you have in focus Peggy and Fred looking at each other as Homer and Wilma are exchanging their vows. So you have two layers of love going on in the frame, and it perfectly mirrors a shot earlier in the film where Hoagy Carmichael, the piano player, is playing it's like chopsticks or something, right?
They play he and Homer play it together,
play chopsticks on a piano at the bar they've been going to, and in the background in the phone booth you don't hear what he's saying, but Fred is, for all practical purposes, breaking up with Peggy.
It's incredible. He's in a phone booth and it's like, you can't hear what he's saying, but you know, there's such an emotional weight in the back of the, in the back of the room over there. There's this deep, heavy thing happening. And right over here, we have this great chopsticks being played. And then Al is sitting there listening to the piano, completely distracted by the thing that's behind him. And he like can't react positively to their song.
There's just so much, there's just so much going on. In the frame. And I mean, like, going back to whenever he comes home for the first time, you get a perfectly in focus shot of them hugging down the hall while looking at the kids on either side of the frame in the foreground. Reacting to their, so there's a lot of really great instances of, deep focus photography in this movie. Yeah.
The moment I was actually talking about that's the best shot is that at the wedding. And then at the end of that, the wedding's done and they're happy. So to set this up just a little bit more, Peggy and Fred have been distant for quite a while. Fred
is now social distancing.
There you go. But he's gotten divorced, right? What's his wife's name? I forgot again. She's left him. Marie,
yeah.
She's left him. He's living on his own, and he's about to leave town, actually. And then they have this moment during the vows where they're making eye contact and, like, realizing almost, like, we feel this towards each other. Like, this is happening kind of thing. And then the wedding's done. Everyone congregates in one moment, in one area. And then in the background, you can almost barely notice it at first. They come together and start kissing, and it's like...
Yeah, they're the only two that don't move.
Yeah.
Because this was all done in the living room, there's no party down the aisle after it's over. Everyone just kind of gathers and is congratulating the happy couple, and they don't move, and one's on one side of the frame, one's on the other, and one's in the foreground, one's in the background. They're both in complete focus, and you just see them staring at each other, and it all happens right there.
It's really amazing how much is happening that's not happening, like how much subtext there is that you feel the weight of so strongly.
And we just talked about all these characters, like pretty much every major character in the film we just talked about, and I mean, like, they're all likable, interesting characters, you know, and they all have something going on that makes them compelling.
That's why it needed to be 3 hours really to capture remarkable. All that.
Yes. And I like that it's 3 hours, because it doesn't, you know, the pacing is still good, but it doesn't rush you through any of these stories that deserve the time.
Yeah. It doesn't shortchange anybody's arc.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody gets there, and it very seamlessly goes from story to story in a way that feels very natural. And they intertwine in a way that is, I mean, it's just so well done, guys. You need to see
seriously
this movie.
Watch it. I would have, again, this is one I never would have watched. Like, if I picked this up on the shelf, I'd be like, no, not interested. I'm so glad I watched this. It is incredible.
And it did win, like, I mean, like, there's a reason it won like 8 Academy Awards.
Let's look at the award
list. It's a Wonderful Life. I think that is worth noting.
Yeah.
It's a Wonderful Life, which it was interestingly, like, I feel sometimes like, you know, we get into these legends about movies like It's a Wonderful Life and The Wizard of Oz about how unpopular they were when they came out, and then they became popular later. And that is true to the extent that the movies were not as big a success as the studios making them thought they were going to be. And then they were very much rediscovered on television, and through annual television airings, particularly The Wizard of Oz started being aired annually, I think in the '50s, and that's when it really started to take off. But the movie itself was still in the public consciousness, and Over the Rainbow was still a huge song. And Judy was using it to end all of her concerts from the '50s, early '50s onward. So it still was still a popular movie. It was just also an extremely expensive movie that didn't make back its budget. Because of how much it cost to produce. And then It's a Wonderful Life, similar situation. It did respectable business. And then it got nominated for a bunch of awards. It just wasn't as big a hit as they were anticipating. And some of that probably has to do with the fact that It's a Wonderful Life is a little bit darker than perhaps it was advertised. And then it was rediscovered on television, and it was in the public domain for a long time and got, you know, played to death on TV. And so everybody knows it now. But it's interesting, because I think you could look at Best Years of Our Lives and It's a Wonderful Life, and you could have very accurate arguments for either movie being the better film, because they are both really great movies in very different ways, and they both deal with post-World War II angst in different ways. But the thing is, sometimes the movie that wins Best Picture is the one that says something about the moment. And while I could talk to you about how It's a Wonderful Life is very much a post-World War II movie and why.
Yeah, it's not explicitly so, maybe.
It's less explicitly, Yeah. And The Best Years of Our Lives is very much saying something about its moment. And I like the fact that it wins Best Picture too, because sometimes you need a movie to have that award so that people go back and revisit it. You know, and the fact is, the reason why someone like you might actually find out what The Best Years of Our Lives is, is because they gave it Best Picture in 1946. And so you will see it on a list and you'll go, why did this movie win Best Picture? And then you go back and you learn something about 1946.
You know? So it did win Best Picture. I was going to run through the awards. So it also won Best Music. And then Best Film Editing, Best Writing, which completely deserved. That's Robert E. Sherwood wrote the screenplay, and Best Director for William. Go ahead.
I think he wrote Rebecca. Anyway,
I'll find that.
It's really random.
he did. He wrote Rebecca and The Bishop's Wife.
Yes. That's a Christmas movie that was nominated for Best Picture.
And then William Wyler, who we've talked about, Best Actor in Supporting Role as Harold Russell, Actor in a Leading Role for Frederick March as Al, and then Best Picture. And then Harold Russell also won, you mentioned that honorary award. And then on IMDb here, it has the text of what the award was, for bringing hope and courage to his fellow veterans through his appearance in The Best Years of Our Lives, which is so sweet and great. I love that.
That is really sweet. I think that that award was given to him in large part because they didn't think he was going to win Best Supporting Actor.
But he deserves something,
And then he ended up, because he beat out, all some heavy hitters. He beat out poor Claude Rains, who again lost Best Supporting Actor. He was nominated for Notorious, which is a really great Hitchcock movie.
And Claude Rains from Casablanca, we mentioned a few episodes back,
Claude Rains is one of those supporting actors that character actors who is in, I don't think character actor is the right word. I think he's just a great kind of mid-level star who is heavy supporting in a whole bunch of movies, including Casablanca and The Adventures of Robin Hood and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And, you know, he's in all these great films. He's in Lawrence of Arabia. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. But he really deserved an Oscar. And I'm very sad that he didn't get one, but I can't really argue that Harold Russell didn't deserve it.
There you go.
sorry, Claude.
He was also up that year against William Demarest. Is that how you say that?
Demarest,
not familiar with him.
You would know him if you saw him, because he... he is in, so hold on, let me,
he's going. In Mr. Smith Goes to Washington as well, and It's a Mad World. I've seen that one.
I was going to say, he was on a TV show, My Three Sons, which lasted a while, and he has if you look at his face, you probably are like, oh yeah, that guy, because he's in, he's just in familiar. He's in so many movies, and he was one of the people in the stable of, a director named Preston Sturges, who did a bunch of really great comedies, including The Palm Beach Story and Sullivan's Travels and My Favorite Wife, The Lady Eve, that's the name of the movie. And you should discover those if you ever get the chance.
And the other two were Charles Coburn for The Green Years and Clifton Webb for The Razor's Edge, which had a lot of nominees. I was seeing Razor's Edge on. Anne Baxter won for Razor's Edge that year.
I've seen it.
And then it was also up for Best Picture. Anyway.
Razor's Edge is a really good movie. It is not on the level of Best Years of Our Lives, but
It's a title I've heard but never seen. But anyway,
I think it's a novel. It's a book. It's a famous book too. So anyway, point of story. Best Years of Our Lives, perfect.
Perfect movie.
You should watch it and then rewatch it, because it's just pleasant to revisit.
Absolutely. It seems like one that I can watch again, pick up again in a couple of years, and just fall right back into it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I can't think, are there any other things we need to mention? We've kind of gone through the cast and crew, I think.
What was the placing in the AFI list? I feel like I...
Best Years of Our Lives, 37.
And then it was number 11 on the AFI Top 100 Cheers, which are our most inspirational movies.
Oh, interesting.
So, and then, of course, National Film Registry and all that jazz.
Well, there you go.
And BAFTA, Best Award for Best Film from Any Source, Golden Globe for Best Drama. I mean,
yeah, that is interesting that it did well in the UK. That, I guess, having that kind of universal war experience story. Pretty interesting.
I mean, it makes sense though, because this was the story probably for a lot of people. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that is the Best Years of Our Lives. Fantastic movie. Go watch it. And next time, speaking of AFI, we are going to be talking about the number one movie that was number one on both lists you mentioned, and that is Citizen Kane. So come back and listen to that in a couple weeks. And I'm very much looking forward to that discussion.
Can't wait.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Rance, and we'll talk to you next time.
See you soon.
Big thanks once again to my guest Rance Collins for making this series so compelling. We have just one more classic film to go, and it is a very big name in cinema history, Citizen Kane. Join us next time for that discussion, and maybe watch the movie if you never have. Until then, rate and review the podcast if you want to support us, or buy an Art House Garage t-shirt on the website at arthousegarage.com/shop. Connect on social media. We are at Art House Garage on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Letterboxd, or you can email me, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And that is it for this show. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, keep it snob free.